Hello and welcome to Euractiv's AgriFood podcast. I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And I'm Natasha Foote.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's AgriFood team. So this week started with a new proposal from the Portuguese presidency when it comes to one of the thorniest aspects of the common agricultural policy, so the main EU farming subsidies program that is currently under discussion between the European Council and the European Parliament. So the two lawmakers are stuck in the moment on the green architecture of the new common agricultural policy reform. And the Portuguese presidency wants, in a bid to break this deadlock, they presented a new proposal on eco-scheme. So eco-scheme, we're talking about the main bonds of contention, of course, but also we're talking about the most important aspect when it comes to the greening of the EU farming subsidies program. So you remember, Natasha, the European Parliament in October voted for ring fencing, so put a limit in the budget spent.
I do remember. Feels like a long time ago, actually. A lot has happened since.
And the ring fencing of the European Parliament was at 30% of the budget in the first pillar. So the pillar of the cap devoted to the direct payments to farmers. The council position is at 20%. Is it 20%? So the
gotta find a compromise somewhere. Someone has to move somewhere, basically.
Basically, yes. I mean, we knew that from the beginning, actually. You know, the final figure has to lay somewhere in between. The Portuguese presidency is basically proposing to gradually reach 25% in 2025, starting with a ring fencing of 22%. This is the proposal in order to, you know, meet halfway somehow.
And kind of move progressively up, so it's not as, maybe not as intense.
Yeah, although still I heard from some member state representative that they're not entirely, I mean, there are some member states that are not in favor of, you know, meeting the parliament halfway, no? Yeah, they're still a bit, they want the Portuguese presidency to be stick with the mandate, the original mandate of 20%. And this is going to be discussed. I mean, this proposal will be, of course, proposed by the Portuguese presidency to the other EU agriculture minister in the next AgriFish Council that will take place
On Monday. Well, depends when you're listening to this, actually.
Yeah.
On the 26th.
Yeah, we have a lot of listenings on Monday, mysteriously.
Yeah.
No, of course, I mean, listeners want to start their week properly.
Listening to our dulcet tones. Is there a better way to start the week? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. And yeah, it's an informal AgriFish Council because it's not in presence and it will be web streamed, let's say. There are also other aspects that will be attached, not only the CAP reform package with the new proposal on eco-scheme, but also the market situation, also considering future challenges, of course, and also the issue of trade is high on the agenda, as well the EU strategy on animal welfare.
What are they not talking about? Yeah. Very broad.
And food labeling, of course.
Oh, there's another one.
But Tash, there are also other aspects. We spoke to Norbert Linz, the chair of the Agriculture Committee of the European Parliament last week, and he basically described or at least outlined other thorny issue between the Parliament and the Council.
of which there are several still sticking points to be discussed.
But today we're more interested in one.
Yes, exactly. I took the words out of my mouth. Well, one of them that is one of these thorny issues is this issue of the definition of an active farmer, what it means to be a farmer. And this, you know, has a large effect on the way that the subsidies are kind of doled out. But I won't go on about it because actually we have our guest today here to talk about this issue. So today we have with us Morgan Ozy, who is a member of the European Coordination Via Campesina, who works a farmers association that works to support small farmers. And Morgan's also a farmer herself. So we spoke to her to hear a little bit more about this issue of what it means to be an active farmer. Thanks very much for being with us today. So I'm sure what you know is that, you know, one of the main kind of sticking points of these CAP negotiations is on the definition of what it means to be an active farmer. So maybe in your words, you could explain to us what you think it means to be an active farmer for you.
Well, for us, it's very simple. Genuine farmers are the people who are doing the work on the farm. So they are the people with an agricultural activity who are not employees and whose main source of revenue comes from this agricultural activity. So it's quite basic. For us, the farmer are the people driving the tractor, planting the seeds and doing the real actual agricultural activity.
I will also ask you, how important is this definition of farmer for directing the common agricultural policy funds and also for future decisions on supporting small farmers?
Actually, the definition of genuine farmer is very important because we all know that right now, most of the CAP payment go to the biggest farms. And actually, in some of these farms, it's only nominal farmers or farmers by name only, meaning that in some of these farms, there are people employing other companies who do the actual work on the fields. And for us, this is not really farmers, meaning that in order to be a farmer, you have to be to do the actual work and not only call for an agricultural company to say, okay, can you go and do the harvest on the farm? So of course, in many farms, for some specific works, you can ask for another company to do it. And that's okay. There's no problem for that. But we know that, for example, sometimes in arable crops, some people can have the control of hundreds of hectares, never go actually on their field, but ask other company to do the work. And these people, in the current CAP, they do receive the subsidies. And we think that it's not normal. And we would like the actual real farmers, genuine farmers, to receive the payments. And on the other side of the scope, we see that many small-scale family farmers don't receive any CAP payment. For example, in the vegetable sector, many farmers have very small farms, and as the CAP payments are based on hectares, they don't receive anything or very, very little. So we believe that CAP payments should be much more oriented on employment created by and for the farmers.
Morgan, just picking up on something you said there about, you know, money going to genuine small farmers and the CAP payments being redirected towards small farmers. I'm curious. I know you said that you you were farming on a very small farm, 1.3 hectares, I think you said. For you, what does it mean to be a small farmer? I mean, it kind of differs in different countries. You know, what for you is kind of like the cutoff of like hectares? How should we go about, you know, when we talk about small farmers, what do we mean?
Yes, first I want to say that the vast majority of EU farms are very small. Actually, more than half of EU farms are below 5 hectares, and 90% of EU farms are below 30 hectares. So really, we speak about the vast majority of European farms. It's not only a small minority, you know, it's and small farms. I won't tell you, okay, a small farm is below 20 hectares or below 100 hectares, because of course it depends a lot on the production. In arable crops, it can't be the same as in vegetables, of course, because if you already have a farm with 50 hectares of vegetables, it's already quite big, while 50 hectares of arable crop would be very small. So it really depends on the production. Yet in every production, we have quite clear data which show what is a small scale family farm. It's very much about the fact that you can have employees. On the vast majority of agricultural workers actually work in family farms and don't work in factory farms or in huge farms. But it has to be that really your farm is very much linked with the community and the people around.
And lastly, Morgan, I mean, we hosted one of the negotiators in our last episode, the Agriculture Committee Chair, Norbert Linz. He said that they're almost there in terms of reaching an agreement on the definition of farmer. So I would like to ask you, are you, let's say, hopeful for the outcome of this definition in the Common Agricultural Policy talks? I mean, what are your expectations? Are you confident enough?
We would like two things to be included. We as ECVC, we believe that the owners of factory farms or farms in the form of limited companies that occupied vast areas of land, they should not be considered as genuine farmers, but they should be considered as industrialists and not benefit from agricultural support from CAP. On the other side, small-scale farms should be specifically recognized as being employment providers and as having added value, so they should benefit from specific public support. So that would be the two things that we would really add to the definition. Another thing is that we believe that it's not enough to define young farmers, because there are also people who are over 40 years old and want to start in agriculture. And we think that this is great and these people should be supported as well. So we believe that there should be a new definition for new farmers over 40 years old who could benefit from support from the CAP in order to start a new activity in agriculture.
What has happened this week, Natasha?
Well, this week's actually been quite a ruckus, to quote your favourite. I know, I don't use the word lightly because it's your favourite word, but I would say this qualifies as a ruckus. What do you think? Would you agree?
It is, definitely.
I'm
one of the most important expert on ruckuses.
I can say ruckus level.
It's a proper, yeah.
It's a proper
ruckus.
What are we talking about? Well, we're talking about this clash that we saw this week between the EU Farmers Association, COPACOGECA, and a number of farmers, actually, between them and the EU Agricultural Commissioner, Janusz Wojciechowski. So basically, the commissioner, he posted a series of tweets this week criticizing industrial farming. And so he was talking about intensive and industrial methods of animal husbandry. And he was saying that, you know, people that don't defend these methods don't defend rural areas and don't defend farmers. He was saying these methods are not done by farmers. He was talking a lot about, you know, what it means to be an intensive farmer and, you know, really clearly stating his position on this, which was met, I would say, probably fairly predictably with some bad feelings from the farmers, who said basically they feel unrepresented by the agricultural commissioner. It's really provoked this intense debate. We saw it sparked quite a backlash online. But at the same time, we also had people saying that, you know, that they really applauded the commissioner for coming out and saying this, that that this needed to be said, that you know, a lot of those in the kind of environmental quarter saying that yes, he should take a stance against industrial agriculture. So there's been quite a divide in the agricultural community this week over these tweets, over the farming sector who feel unrepresented by their own agricultural commissioner and by those you know, in the environmental,
which is a strong allegation.
Definitely. It's a very strong statement for farmers to come out and say, you know, we don't feel supported by our own commissioner, you know, and really don't feel like they have his backing.
It's also true that, I mean, traditionally, the DG Agri is, you know, considered doing the interests of farmers, no? Because they basically their main
kind
clients.
Of in the name.
Yeah. But at the same time, I always thought that, yeah, of course, I mean, it's not a matter of representation, no? Because otherwise, you know, I mean, we're basically going in the same direction. I mean, it's representing not farmers, but actually the College of Commissioners, no? The European Commission. Sure. You know, there's a difference between representing interests and trying to raise the issues of a certain sector, a certain category, you know, in a certain talk. Seems the same thing, but actually, you know,
it's not quite.
Because I don't see the Agriculture Commission as the top lobbyist of farmers in Europe, no. And, but I also understand the
backlash. The reaction.
The allegations and also the reasoning of the EU Farmers Association after the series of tweets that you mentioned before. And also, I mean, not only the tweets, but even last week, I remember during the hearing in the Joint Agri and Petition Committee, I was quite vocal against intensive livestock farming.
And in favor of small farmers, small-scale farmers.
It seems they kind of made up. He was invited at this conference.
Well, I think he was invited to this conference before.
Before, yeah.
Before this spat. So I'm not sure it was a makeup invitation. But yeah.
But it seems from tweets after he intervened in this assembly that... at least they see positively at next exchanges, let's say.
They managed to find some common ground. Hopefully they'll see a bit more eye to eye. And lastly, this week, the soft drinks company PepsiCo announced their support for regenerative agricultural farming, which... It sounds pretty interesting, sounds kind of innovative. And we took the opportunity to speak to David Wilkinson from PepsiCo about what this entails and what PepsiCo is trying to achieve with this.
Hi, everybody. So my name is David Wilkinson. I head up agricultural procurement for our European procurement team.
So so PepsiCo announced this new positive agriculture ambition this week. Perhaps you could briefly outline this for us. What does this entail? What are you aiming to achieve through this program?
First thing to say is Pepsi, we understand that, you know, we're a business built on agriculture with really crops at the heart of our product portfolio. And we have, you know, a unique sourcing model where we work closely with farmers in the field. And in many cases, you know, we've got relationships with growers for going back two or three generations. What the new announcement is we're committing to do even more to grow our crops and our ingredients in a way that really revitalizes the earth and strengthens farming. And this is the drive and the intent behind our positive agriculture program. And by 2030, what we want to do, and this is a global ambition, is spread the adoption of regenerative agricultural practices across 7 million acres, sustainably source all of our key ingredients such as seasonings, and then also improve the livelihoods and communities of our farming stakeholders. And we want to support more than a million people in our agricultural supply chains.
And you mentioned there that, you know, it will be all the crops that you guys source. What crops exactly are you talking about here? What kind of crops does this involve?
Right. So the our key crops include potatoes, oats, corn, and we also have what we call indirect crops, sunflowers, rape seeds that are processed into our cooking oils, sugar beet. And of course, we source a lot of raw milk in Russia and Ukraine.
And getting into a bit of the nitty gritty of regenerative agriculture here. So the crops you all mentioned there are annual crops, but the core of regenerative agriculture is to use more perennial crops, crops that don't require kind of annual tilling to help regenerate the soil. So I'm wondering, is this program also looking to kind of branch out into these kind of crops as well, kind of support outside of these core crops that you spoke about?
It's a great question. And clearly the whole regenerative agriculture concept is less around one individual crop, but much more around the system and the earth that supports the whole of the crop rotations. So what we're looking to do is partner with our farmers and figure out the very best way of managing the soil that grows our crops. And that might be 1 year potatoes, 1 year oat with a different cover crop, and taking a much more holistic view of, instead of looking at one single crop for a single season, looking at the whole of the rotation. And with that, I think we have the opportunity to broaden our perspective to actually look at, you know, other a broader and different crops.
So I'm reading a bit of figures about the project, 7 million hectares, 3 million tons of GHG, and also 250,000 people involved. There's a lot of numbers involved here, but there are not numbers on how much Pepsi is looking to invest in this program. I mean, how much money is Pepsi investing?
The whole initiative is part of a very broad scope. So I'm not here to talk about specific numbers of what is PepsiCo's investment in this. What I'm really excited about and what I'm able to talk about is some of the practices and some of the activities that we will be engaging with our farmers that will support this whole regenerative concept. I know people talk about investing for sustainability. That may be the case. Our ambition, however, is there are things that make good sense and good financial sense that we can all be doing if we organize in better ways, if we share best practices differently, and if we inspire our farmers to approach the way they grow their crops differently. We think there's a way that is it's a complementary win-win in all of this.
Yeah, there's another question. You're of course aware of the recent green push of the European Union on greening the food system from farm to fork, and there's much talk of how to measure or assess the agricultural footprint of products. So far it's been a tough task, as there are a lot of elements to take into account: emissions, packaging, impact on deforestation, for instance. And at the same time, it's difficult to communicate whatever assessment has been done to consumers. So my questions are, which criteria should we take into account when defining the agricultural footprint according to you, and what tool do we have to communicate this to consumers? Is, for instance, an eco-label feasible?
I'm not really qualified to talk about the best way to communicate with consumers. For me, the most important thing is to partner with like-minded companies, universities, research establishments to really understand how to quantify and codify some of these practices and understand some of the positive impacts that we're making. We know today, we know there's lots of good things that can be done in terms of crop rotations, cover crops, and we shouldn't be stopping our desire to actually implement more of these practices whilst we wait to try to understand every single metric associated with doing what we know to be good. We're really looking forward to working with a broad range of other interested stakeholders to actually help define some mutual industry codes that actually ensures that we're all doing the right things and we all fully understand the positive impacts of what we've done.
And I just wanted to probe a little bit more on kind of how exactly you're kind of supporting farmers in this transition, because often in a conversion from, say, conventional or organic agriculture to regenerative agriculture, this transition doesn't happen overnight. You know, crops can maybe fail in the meantime, and this transition is quite a big hurdle, you know, as systems and practices adapt. And I'm wondering, you know, how PepsiCo proposed to kind of support farmers through this transition. You know, some people have been talking about offering kind of a wage regardless if the crop fails in the first couple of years, for example. Regenerative agriculture is quite a new area, so there's a risk as well for these farmers. So I'm wondering, you know, how you're proposing to kind of support these farmers through this transition.
We've been working with farmers for a long time now, and as part of working with our farmers, we've got a very good understanding of crop data. We've been recording. Take for example our potato crop. We've been recording every field that we grow potatoes. We have very clear metrics and understanding of what practices we performed, what was the result in terms of yield and quality, what was good, what was less good. So we would actually be looking to use this data, share this data, and work with all of the farmers individually to design a path that makes sense for both of us to follow. And it would not be a shot in the dark. It would be, you know, we think we can make some very wise, planful choices based on the data and the algorithms that we have, you know, across our crop intelligence. And for sure, we would make sure that we have the right contracts in place for sourcing the raw materials. We have a long history of implementing innovative and new agricultural practices across our farms. And we have evidence that when something goes wrong, that we make sure that the farmer is looked after. So, you know, we have these experiences to fall back on. But as I said, is we think with the amount of data that we're now capturing and the ability to be able to share this data across all of our farmers, this becomes less of a risk and less of a gamble. We're using data to actually replace some of the gut feel and some of the other decision making criteria that we used in the past.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, the AgriFood podcast was produced, like every week, by Euractiv's AgriFood News team. That's Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foote, with the support of Euractiv's podcast producer, Evie Chiori. You can also find this podcast on all popular streaming platforms, including Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher.
And also be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.